Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH. Know Your Risk Radio is hosted by Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often volatile markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us for yet another of the most scintillating hours in finance radio. And I'm pumped to be here. Probably not a surprise to anybody else, but pumped to be here. And we also have, you know, you guys know what my favorite segment of the show is. We also got a great interview dialed up today with a young man that we've had on before. When I say a young man, I believe he's about 25. And if you haven't heard him on, I've had him on one other time before. He's by far the youngest person I've had on. But the reason that I do is because I think he's young. He's extraordinarily young for what he does. But he's also really good at it. And he is an intense researcher. And that's Edwin Dorsey. We've had him on the show before. He came out this week. He writes a report, a subscription service that has grown rapidly because he does really good work. But he focuses on short selling. He focuses on uncovering frauds in the market. And he came out this week, and he's not a blustery guy, right? He's our style of guy. He's not a show horse. He's a workhorse. And he just loves this stuff, right? He's doing what he loves to do. He loves digging around, researching, finding fraudulent companies. So anyway, he came out this week on Twitter and he said he's releasing a report this week of his highest conviction short call ever. And he's like, I'm sure I'll get beat up for it. I'm sure people think, but he goes, this is one I've been researching. So I asked him to come on the show and walk us through that short thesis he had. And these are always fascinating because I don't know why. You know that show American Greed? I love watching those shows. I love watching the Bernie Madoff stuff. And I don't know why. I had an idea though. And let me sort of explain it this way. When my first son, Kai, my middle child, when he was born or when he was little, he's just always been the sweetest kid. He's just the sweetest kid. But he had this funny thing. He's always kind of sensitive to like monsters and movies and things like that. And when the movie Frozen came out, I almost said Frones because that's how he pronounced it. I think it was like one or two. It was Frones instead of Frozen. But this has to do with finance, trust me. And when the movie Frozen came out, we got to, you know, the kids are all Frozen crazy. It's all we listen to in the car. And one of them got a book. My daughter got a book. She's the oldest one. She's 13, Kai's 11. And he liked to read the book. But what he'd do is we'd get in the car. We'd hand him a book. And he'd suck his thumb. And he'd turn the book open to the page where the big snow monster comes out, which he called the Fonster. The Frona's Fonster. And he would just sit there with the book open to that page, sucking his thumb with this really concerned look on his face. And we would just die laughing because he'd just sit there and stare at it, right? And I made a joke that it was his religion and his mystery, right? I sort of think that's kind of a setup or that's kind of the way that I look at these fraud things. I just find them fascinating, especially on the side of a guy that manages money. And the whole time I sit there and watch these fraud documentaries, I always have this sick feeling in my stomach. And the reason I have a sick feeling in my stomach is when you manage other people's money and it's not going great, it's very hard. I mean, assuming you're not a sociopath, of course, but it's really hard not to take it personally. You know, those people hand their life savings over to you and they trust you and they're asking you to take care of them. And you take that very, very, very personally. And that's what I sit there and watch these guys in these fraud stories and my stomach just tightens up. And of course, there's the moral aspect of fraud and all that, which obviously, you know, is compelling enough for me. I just can't imagine the stress these guys. I'm sitting there looking, I'm going, I'd rather be broke without the stress. I just can't, knowing you're going to get caught. Anyway, so I'm kind of gravitated toward that. We don't short outright. We will use negative indexes as hedges and things like that. But I've always been fascinated by short sellers. There's always been a part of me that's attracted to it. And at some point when we open up a hedge fund that's really non-constrained, shorting will be a part of that. I think it's a valuable way to manage risk if done correctly. But anyway, so Edwin Dorsey, we're going to have on the show, he's just a born short seller. And he's really good at it. And it's just always fascinating. Who doesn't want to hear about a fraud or a suspected fraud, right? It was like when we did that. It was like when we did the expose on Boeing, right? It was a little nerve-wracking. But, you know, you get into those moments and you're like, man, this is what I do it for, right? To get the blood pumping, right? To be passionate about something. What did Teddy Roosevelt say in that one? It's the poor soul that knows neither the thrill of victory or the agony of defeat. Right, the man in the arena. I've got it on my wall right behind me. But anyway, so I'm excited to talk to Edwin. He's such a smart young guy. He's built a really good subscription business that keeps growing, and I think it's going to be fun to have him on and break it down. So anyway, that's enough about that. I even mixed in a Frona's story about the big scary monster. So I'm going to have to save this episode and use it to embarrass Kai at some point. But anyway, let's get on to the market update. So. Some stuff went on this week. Obviously, it all pales in comparison to the Fed meeting. And when we were watching the Fed meeting, I just kind of sat there with my mouth open the whole time. And for those of you who have been listening to Daily Dots, this kind of be a bit of a recap for you because we've been going over this. But I sat there with my mouth open because Powell literally said, over the last 9 months, well, since he was talking about the need to raise, which was nine months ago, or potentially needing to raise again or whatever. Since then, we're 9 months down the track. And he goes, we still continue to make progress against inflation. Yet, on a month-over-month basis, inflation is flat to up over the last 8 months, and it is trending up over the last three. And so I'm not disagreeing with him. I'm not going to do a Fed rant here. So I know some of you like it, but I'm not going to do that here because I wasn't throwing shoes at the screen. Remember that? Remember that was a big deal in the Middle East? I think throw shoes at people. Not that having a shoe thrown at you'd be good, but I always thought that was odd. Yeah. Anyway, wasn't throwing shoes at the screen. Wasn't mad at him. I was just really confused. And what I was really confused by is I'm listening to him walk through the economic data. I'm looking at it myself. I'm watching inflation tick higher. I'm watching all these things occur. And I just don't know how you can look at the data set that we're currently staring at and think to yourself that you need to cut rates. Now, I can see reasons why they would. Right? Like commercial real estate, you know, housing affordability. The only problem is I honestly believe in the market you're currently in. If you cut rates while it make a mortgage more affordable, I think it's just going to push price housing back up. And when you consider how tight housing still is, now there's a lot more supply coming on the market. But when you consider how tight housing still is, I kind of think that if you lower the cost of mortgage, the average house price will go up that much. Right? So what are we left to believe? And Chase and I were talking about this on the Daily Dots yesterday. This is the tough part about it. They have literally not reached. Now, there'll be people that disagree with me. That's fine. But in my opinion, they're manufacturing their own inflation prints because they're like, well, if you pull this out of it, if you pull out housing out of it, look at this. And you're like, well, okay. Well, if you don't pay taxes next year, you'll make a lot more money, but you're going to pay taxes. I hate those theoretical, these people are also stupid. Of course, inflation's down. If you remove this and that, well, but you can't remove that. And they're like, well, 65% of homeowners are locked in at low interest rates. So high housing prices don't affect them. And it affects everybody trying to buy one, which has a big impact on construction companies, which has a big impact on construction labor. And as you guys know, and hopefully you know, that when unemployment spikes into a recession, what's the first thing to give? Construction jobs. Right? So, you know, what really matters, and then think about the housing company, right? Those jobs, the companies themselves sell, like, there's a supply constraint. Certainly. Now, I don't think the supply constraint, well, it's not, right? There's not a lack of houses. There's a lack of houses for sale. But I mean, that, you know, that's also economic growth, right? Economic mobility. It really isn't with the, you know, it's not a huge economic difference. You know, when I sell my place and go buy a new one, what is a big economic difference is when two younger people get married and they buy their first home. That's, we call that household formation. That's the beginning of them spending the largest percentage of their income and deploying it out into the economy because they're raising a family, they're having kids, there's all these other things, right? All these other factors. And to sit there and listen to Powell talk about all the progress we made with inflation, it really puts you in a spot. It really puts you in a tough spot when you're trying to interpret what he said. Okay, because, and I'm not calling him a liar. Do I think he's lying? Yes, of course I do. But I hate saying that about people that I don't know. I don't like to disparage people's character unless I know it's bad, right? And I don't know that. I actually think he seems like a pretty measured guy. I actually think he seems like a pretty balanced, fair guy. And I don't have anything personal against him. I also think that he makes a lot less of these decisions than he gets credit for, whether right or wrong. Yeah. So in some ways, I feel like, you know, when I gripe about the Fed, to be fair to them, the Fed's job really is to facilitate what government wants to do, right? Now, I think that there's another layer, and I don't want to get into that. I think there's another layer of responsibility that they've shirked, meaning I think that the Fed has allowed the government to run way further than they otherwise would have, right? Because they've made the pain of profligate spending go away. And to a certain extent, they're supposed to, right? I understand all that. Because they're not policymakers, right? What they're supposed to do is they're supposed to keep everything stable despite what the policymakers are doing. Now, I obviously think they've overstepped their bounds. I think it's a really hard argument to make that they haven't. But again, we want to be fair. We want to get this right, right? This isn't about blasting somebody. This isn't about scoring points on social media or any of that nonsense. But it was really perplexing because you're sitting there going, okay, what you're saying isn't true. You're not making progress. That's ridiculous. It's actually moving against you. Manufacturing looks to be bottoming as well. We have several manufacturing reports. We've been talking about the recession in manufacturing, right? It looks to be bottoming, meaning we're seeing now positive manufacturing prints pretty much everywhere we look. Not huge. And remember, this is what we were talking about going into the year, was saying, look, we think economic data is going to be way better than even we were thinking simply because of the move up in stocks. And that's what you're seeing. And I have got no indicator at this point that the Fed is aware of that. Now, maybe we're wrong. Maybe there's nothing to be aware of. But it looks pretty clear to us that asset prices going up is the biggest economic driver at present. I also think it's a huge, you know, stimulus, if you will, to consumer spending. But the biggest key, I think, that occurred, and I heard a lot of people saying, they didn't cut. That wasn't the key to it, man. Despite all of this hot information, despite the fact that inflation is ticking back up, Powell sat there and said, we're sticking with 3 interest rate cuts this year. 3 cuts. And it kind of throws you into a conundrum because you're sitting there going, wait a second. None of the benchmarks that you guys said need to be reached in order to cut. And to be fair to them, they didn't lay out concise, but there were certain goals, right? There are things they wanted to accomplish, a target rate of inflation at 2. Now, Powell has since said that he should probably start cutting rates before he reaches 2, which I don't disagree with. But bottom line, still none of those things have been met. And yet you're going to throw three at it while things look to be accelerating, while government spending picks up in the second half as well. It's going to be lighter in the first half this year, heavier in the second half. And so there's really only two. So all of the things that they said would be required to cut rates, they haven't reached there, but yet they're still reiterating three rate cuts. So then that leads you to believe, okay, following that line of logic, then why are you cutting rates? That to me really is the question, guys. And unfortunately, I don't like to speculate, but that's all we can do because I don't have a phone call. I don't have the bat phone to give old Jay Powell a call, or I would. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we can swing enough. Hey, Zach Abraham from Bulwark Capital is on the phone. I got to take this. Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. no, but the interesting thing about it is, then why are you cutting? And that's kind of where Chase and I came to the other day. We were having this discussion off air, and then we had a more condensed conversation on air during the dots. But we just said that, you know, the thing that is so perplexing to us about this is what they're saying is the reasons they're cutting for. They're obviously not. Those things haven't reached. Why are they cutting? Is there something they see underneath the surface that's scaring them? Could it be commercial real estate? Probably not commercial real estate because it's too small. But basically, we boiled it down to two things that we think it is. A, maybe it's just as simple as it's an election year, and they are determined to try to keep things as easy and free-flowing as possible. On the bright side, because they don't want markets in the economy to be a factor. On the more nefarious side, it's because they don't want Trump in the eye. Again, I don't know. When I hear those people talk, I really don't think Trump probably has any allies on the FOMC. So I don't think that's a stretch at all to believe that they're kind of playing that game, right? Trying to make things look as good as possible to try to prevent a Trump election. And then the only other one that we could think of is Jay Powell is a private equity guy. He built a greater than $100 million net worth in private equity. Private equity is feeling pain right now. And the reason I think that it's one of those two issues that's driving the Fed is, like I said, the reasons that they're throwing out, they just don't cut the mustard, man. It just doesn't really make any sense. And none of these things could be right, but we're just sitting there grasping at straws going, what in the world is getting these guys to think that looser monetary policy is possible? And I think that there's one other thing. There's one other possibility. And for those of you who've been listening to the show for a long time, you know you've heard me talk about the Fed being painted into a corner. And I always believed that we would see a rampant inflation, but real inflation wouldn't hit until markets and the populace realized that the situation had gone too far and that there was not going to be a return to normal. We were never going to go to a post-cutting or a post-rate cut, post-quantitative easing, post-stimulating world. That the excesses you have built up in the economy are just too large. You know, back in the day, 70s and 80s, those excesses weren't nearly as large. So when you want to stamp out inflation, you just kept jacking rates. Mild recession, they got rates all the way up 70, 18. Why? Because no, we weren't drowning in debt. You can't do that today. And so I long thought that you'd see a bout of inflation. They'd try to fight it the typical way. That way would bring about, you know, raising interest rates. That way, that would obviously, in a massively indebted world, would bring along with it financial instability. And then they'd quickly realize that they had to reverse course and that they were going to have to live with higher inflation. And that, guys, I think that's where we're at. I could be wrong, but I think that's where we're at. I think it was some combination of those three things, right? Not wanting Trump in office. Private equity and commercial real estate stress. I think that's part of it. And then the other part of it, I think that they're realizing that they can't take their finger off the scale. They can't take their thumb off the scale. The excesses are too large. You know, whether it's quantitative easing, whether it's whatever, I think that's where we're at. And the market seems to think that as well. Why do I say that? Gold and crypto. I've long thought that that would be when gold started to, when gold finally went on its run, would be at the end of this cycle, not during it. Now, all of these things still need to be confirmed. We're still in the early ages, and 12 months from now, I could be sitting there saying I was wrong. And I don't think it's going to be a smooth thing. I don't think it's that full realization point yet, but I think we're getting really close to just everybody waking up and realizing we're never going to get out of this. Not until there's a massive default. And the reason why is because you've got a debt-driven economy, right? That's choking on record levels of it at the consumer balance sheets as it relates to household wealth are still really in good shape, and so are their personal balance sheets as far as debt. The consumer's nowhere near as stretched as it was in 08, 09. So that looks good, right? But what the consumer is facing that they weren't then is massively higher prices, right? So that is straining them. Then when we want to talk about debt, it's the corporations, the corporate balance sheets, government balance sheets, et cetera, right? That's where the real issue is. And the problem with that is, yeah, maybe consumers aren't dealing with a lot of debt now, but I don't really see, considering what corporations and governments are up against, I don't really see an ability for them to, like I said, I just think inflation is going to be higher for longer. I don't see them having the ability to release that pressure off consumers. And if I'm right, we're going to get into this in the second segment of the conundrum we face. Because it is a bit unnerving. We're going to have to do something that really nobody's had to do in modern financial history. We got to fight two wars at once. Now, we got to take a quick break. But if you see this insanity and you're looking at your portfolio and you're going, with all of this going on, I know my guy just says to buy and hold, and so far it's worked. But how does this continue? And I know I need to stay invested because there's the threat of this going way higher. At the same time, when I look at valuations and debt, there is huge potentials for massive things to go wrong. What do I do? Just staying long and staying in stocks seems crazy given these values. If these are the thoughts going through your head, what happens if the election, hey, look, hopefully nothing bad happens. It just feels to me like we're all smoking a cigar around a powder keg. And if that concerns you, which I think it should, give us a call because you don't have to gamble at all. There's a way where we can give you actually more upside potential in the portfolio, lower your fees, and drastically reduce your risk. So if it is a runaway inflationary type bubble market, we can benefit from it without risking catastrophic loss on the other side. Take some discipline, but we can do it. You don't need to chance this. The retirement should not be a game of craps. It should be a plan. You should know under the worst circumstances, how much risk do I have in play? If we got hit, how bad would it look? You should have the security to know it can't get any worse than this, whatever that number is. It's called risk management. We do it every day, guys. Give us a call, 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. Stick with us through the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
2024 has the potential to be a wild ride. Are you confident your portfolio is protected? Risk management has never been more important. Join Bulwark Capital's Zach Abraham for his 2024 Outlook live webinar, Thursday, March 28th.
Todd, with the election looming, continued global unrest, rising cost of living, and this crazy market volatility, protecting retirement portfolios has never been more critical, and it's our number one focus.
Don't just ride out 2024. Join Zach for his live webinar and learn how they actively manage every portfolio.
We do it with Bulwark's risk management strategy, always seeking opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give you as much upside as possible.
Don't miss Zach's free 2024 Outlook live webinar, Thursday, March 28th, Register now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com.
Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. Thank you for sticking with us through the break. One other thing that I forgot that I left out of the market update. I'm going to keep pounding on this table just because I get very frustrated at the nonsensical and biased way that everything seems to be reported, right? Like it's, if anytime you're listening to an economic assessment, it's almost like you need to see somebody's political profile before you listen to a word they say. And I think that both sides are guilty of it at times, right? Oh, it's a horrible economy. Oh, it's the greatest economy in the world. It's a Frankenstein economy, man. I mean, if you're looking at it through an unjaundiced view and setting the bias aside, yeah, there are parts of it that are really benefiting from all this printed money and excess and all that other kind of stuff. And then there's companies doing well too, right? Then the flip side is that this environment is brutalizing other people, other companies, other things. And it wasn't horrible, but an earnings report came out today that caught my eye. And it wasn't bad, but it does not fit the booming economy narrative. And that was the Nike earnings report. Now, I didn't deep dive into it, but their stock got hit a bit after it came out. Part of it was because, and I'd actually been thinking about this, part of it was because they're going to incur additional costs and charges due to releasing some new styles. And I'd been thinking about that lately, and what had got me thinking about it is the resurgence of all the Jordan-branded stuff, right? All the different shoes. For instance, for Christmas this year, all three of my kids asked for a pair of they're the 11s, the Jordan 11s. They're the white ones that have the shiny patent leather around the sides of them, you know? My wife got me a pair of them for my birthday a couple of years back. Was it 2 years back? Just because that was one of those shoes as a kid that I always wanted. It was funny because I didn't ask for them, but when I got them, I was really pumped. Anyway, what is that about? What is that about? There's plenty of things that weren't that way as a kid, but with shoes, I'm wearing a pair of them right now. The Penny Hardaway. It's casual day in the office today, but wearing a set of Penny Hardaways. It was another pair of shoes that I wanted as a kid that I could never, couldn't get. But anyway, I'll get back to my point. But if you think about that, that's probably the most profitable shoes they've ever sold. There was no development cost. There was no new create. They just pulled out the old designs and ran them again. They didn't have to do a lot of marketing. They marketed themselves. And amazing for them. An amazing sign of the strength of their business. But it also was one of those things. What got me thinking about it was one of those things you look at that's awesome. And does great things for the balance sheet and the income statement, but also kind of smacks of peak profitability, right? For instance, they're not going to be able to keep reduplicating this, right? Why? There's no Michael Jordan's a one-off. Now you'll get a couple, like I bought the Penny Hardaway throwback shoes and things like that, but it's kind of a one-off. And it's not going to stay this hot, right? My kids aren't going to want new, retro Jordans every single Christmas. But it's also a look through to the consumer. And I think it shoots a hole. And if the economy is booming the way they're telling us that, and we've given you tons of different examples of how that's not the case. But in a consumer-driven economy, if it is booming, why is Nike down 50%? And it's still not cheap. I actually think it's approaching some decent value here. That's not a recommendation to buy it. But it's on our watch list because I do think they're a phenomenal company. But again, just kind of blowing a hole in the narrative of that strong economy thing. So, okay, getting on to the next one, the conundrum that we're currently facing here. Let me apologize in advance because there is an aspect of this that is self-serving. But it wasn't intended to be. This is just the kind of environment that we've been afraid of, that we've been expecting. But more importantly, when you're in the business of managing people's retirement assets, I didn't see it coming, or who could have seen it coming? That doesn't work. And I'm not at all saying that this is the case, but if it were, if this was like a 1929, 2008 scenario, I didn't see it coming isn't good enough. Right? It's your life savings. It's how you fund the twilight, you know, it's how you sail off into the sunset. It should be the culmination of a life's work. And that should be able to stand up to anything. And this is where the conundrum comes in. And we've never really faced one like this before. And the conditions, these sort of conditions have really existed for a while now, kind of as long as central banks have been stimulating and the Fed has been stimulating and the government's been doing crazy stuff. These conditions aren't new, but they are at an extreme level now. And those conditions are, we are literally fighting a war on two fronts. You have tons of examples of fundamentals being disconnected from reality. Tons of things that you would look at in the past that would be signs of peak frothiness. You know, look at crypto, look at how nuts that's going. Look at the kind of coins that are performing the best. Look at the kind of stocks that are still performing the best. It's very meme driven. It's very frothy. It's very bubbly. And there are reasons for that, right? That's the other tough part about that. There are reasons for that. Why? Well, should it surprise us to see a frothy market when the Fed or any other central bank around the world or any other government around the world or government apparatus or whatever the case may be won't allow any bad shoes to drop? That papers over every single problem with printed money? I mean, that kind of seems like the policy decisions or the directions or the trajectories, if you will, that policymakers would go down that would create a frothy environment. And yet at the same time, when we're referring to corporate balance sheets and we're referring to government balance sheets, we're the most indebted we've ever been. And why is that important? Because debt really, when we're thinking about recessions or you think about downturns, debt's kind of like the firewood, right? Debt tends to be in downturns. It's what's going to burn, especially when you haven't had a default cycle in 15 years. And let me reiterate again, historically speaking, we get one every 6.5 years, a recession, default cycle, right? The bad things get knocked over. Think of it as like a forest fire, right? The weak trees burn down, the stronger ones survive. It thins out the herd, allows the stronger ones to get more sunlight, to get more water, right? These natural cycles exist. That's why I made the point about the Judaic law, about the 7-year jubilee. And I'm not coming at you guys from a biblical angle here. That's not my point. But I'm saying, you know, you go look back in Mosaic law 2,500 years ago, and they adhered to a recessionary reset every 7 years, right? Clean out the mess, eliminate the debt, write it off. And then we have a recession every 6.5 years on average until we made a policy decision that these things aren't palatable anymore. But what's my point in that? My point is that you're fighting a war on both fronts. Really, for the first time in history, you're looking at an unbelievable amount of fuel set up to make really nasty things happen on a fundamental level to the downside for most asset classes, perhaps all of them. Yet at the same time, when you look at the fiscal situation here in the United States, when you look at monetary policy here in the United States, when I sit there and listen to Jerome Powell with rising inflation, at present, manufacturing looking like it's bottoming, talking about cutting rates. Again, this was the scenario that we've been talking about for the last 6 to 8 months. And he reiterated he's going to do it. This will be the first time the Fed has cut into rising inflation and growth anywhere near this hot. And we actually went back and looked at the data. I think that there were probably more reasons to print in 98 when they did that, or not print, excuse me, to cut rates in 98 when they did. And the reason I say that is in 98, when long-term capital blew up, the precursor to that was the Asian currency crisis. So you kind of understand, you know, you had two of those things blow up in a row pretty close to each other. And I can understand the trepidation of central bankers at that time. And people are like, well, we had Silicon Valley Bank. Yeah, but the conditions are completely different. Meaning, you know, maybe a few permabears on the side were worried about the regional banks. I mean, we certainly talked about them at that time, but you knew how it was going to end. The question was which one will they let ceremonially go? And how many will they let ceremonially go? I was not going to rescue them all because that's bad optics. But this is just a different setup. We all know, right? They're in for a penny, in for a pound. They got to do it. So we have to fight both. And people are like, well, what do you mean? They're going to keep printing and rates are getting cut. It's to the sky. Well, yeah, that's the way it looks to me too. Okay, but when you're looking at a fundamental picture like this, you'd be a fool. Like, because basically what you're saying is, if you go all in on that side of it, the government can't quit. And I agree with you. They can't quit spending money. They can't quit printing. If anything goes wrong, the Fed will intervene. But I agree with you. But when you're operating in a market like this, where so many of these things are so detached from fundamentals, and they've run so long, and there's so much debt, and there's all of this fuel out there for bad things to happen, any unforeseen little thing here or there or whatever could change the map in a hurry and kind of create an shoot moment, right? Where everybody realizes, wait a second. We're doing the trapeze without a net below us. And then reality can come back into focus really quick. So we got to stay invested. We got to stay invested strategically because the inflation's coming. It ain't going anywhere. You should know that. And it's going to ebb and flow. I'm not saying it's going right back to 9 or 10. I'm not saying that. But I just think we've been saying this for a while now, and I think you're seeing it play out in front of you. And for that matter, I think that the Fed has basically admitted it. Higher rates of inflation are here for a longer period of time. And what makes this so odd, I mean, you go back and look at market multiples the last time we were fighting inflation. They weren't anywhere close to this. 70s, 80s, I think in 1980, I think I was it 80 or 81, the S&P was trading at 3.5 times earnings. Today you're approaching 30. This is why we push risk management all the time, guys. This is not your grandpa and grandma's market. It's just not. And I'm not, like I said, that's why I gave that precursory warning. It's going to sound like I'm pitching my book. I get it. But let's exclude that part of it. Let's exclude that we do risk management, that you're listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Why do we do it? Look at the backdrop. Look at it. You guys can see it. Don't be the people sitting there, well, who could have seen it? What do you mean? Longest you've ever been without a recession. Look at all. And you know what? Quite honestly, guys, a recession ain't the fear. We know what's going to happen in a recession. They're going to cut rates to zero. Fed will keep doing quantitative easing. And if that doesn't do the trick, everybody will send out a check. I'm worried about other things. I'm worried about wars, geopolitical issues. And what's so concerning about them, if stocks were cheap right now, I think it'd be probably a great time to buy them. Because if stocks were cheap right now, probably because everybody's overestimating global fears. And then there's another side of it. When you're buying something cheap enough, you're not really that, I mean, most of the time, right? But you're not really worried about if things go wrong. You bought it cheap. If you hold it long enough, you're going to make money. Like Buffett says, right? It's no bad assets, just bad prices. But you got to have a portfolio that can stand up to both. And I actually was asked to be on the Hidden Forces podcast and this Q&A session with an expert. You may not think I'm an expert. It sounds weird when people say that to me. But they had me on. I was the expert answering questions that day. And retirement planning came up. And these are some very astute investors. And we got into it, and I just said, look, I think that retirement planning needs to – and I, you guys have heard me say this a million times, but think how stupid – let's just walk through it. Last 10 years of retirement, on average, you're making more money than you ever made in your life. Therefore, the contributions in your 401k are the biggest they've ever been. And about 96% of the time, when people go into retirement, their portfolio is exactly the same as it was over the previous 10 years of their employment. How does that make any sense? A portfolio that makes sense for you when you are making your largest 401k contributions in your working career, that portfolio works just as well when you start taking withdrawals? How is that possible? It's not. It's not the right way to position people for retirement. A retirement plan should have a fail-safe, meaning Yeah, can it go up and down? Sure, everything can. But can your retirement portfolio blow you up? Can it make your retirement unviable? And if it's a traditional portfolio, not only can it do that, it's done it multiple times over the last 100 years. And I don't think that it's I don't think it is hyperbolic at all to say that you are facing a bigger set of risks today, to both sides, inflation and deflation, than at any time over the last 100 years. And like I said, those portfolios have gotten annihilated and ruined retirements multiple times over the last 100 years. And this is the part of the job that gets so frustrating for me. Like, it's the human part of the job. Can I promise you that we're going to give you the best performance? No, I can't make that promise. Can I promise you we're never going to have years of underperformance? We just did last year. But you know where our underperformance is? It's when we make less. You know why that's important? Because making less in a year doesn't ruin anybody's retirement. It doesn't mean you have to start over. Not to mention the two previous years, we made more and lost significantly less. But there's a better way to do this, guys. There's a risk-managed way to do this so you can sleep easy at night knowing that no matter what happens, it's not going to be, might not be fun, but it's not going to be a retirement ender. It's not going to change the reality that you've been working for and working toward for 40 years. There's a better way. There is absolutely a better way that we can drastically reduce your risk, give you potentially more, more upside potential in your portfolio, you know, to where we can keep it safe. But if we're right about this thing going parabolic, we can actually benefit from it too. But also make sure that you got a chair when the music stops. And that should interest you. And if it does, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. We're going to air about 10 minutes of my interview with Edwin Dorsey. It's about his newest and greatest short selling idea. And guys, I almost am remiss. I apologize for some language that got squeezed through. If you guys know me, I've never sworn on any of these podcasts. I love the guys we have on. And what we typically do when we're going to air it on the show here is we edit it. We did that. There was a ball drop between me and the producer. It got missed. So I apologize for that. But if anybody heard any swearing last week or it was around any kids, my full apologies. Now I will give you a warning though. I try not to edit that stuff out of the interview because I want people to be heard in their words. So maybe I'll start. What we're going to start doing is issuing a warning on any of the episodes that do have any adult language in there. But I want to get people talking in a stream of conscious. I want to hear their real thoughts. And sometimes those come with swear words. But anyway, I apologize for that last week. We're going to do our best to make sure it doesn't happen again. But anyway, so stick with us through the break. We'll be right back to air a few minutes or about eight, nine minutes of that interview. And then as always, you can go to Know Your Risk Radio podcast, hear the rest of it. I think Edwin's a fascinating guy, super bright guy, and fun to chat with. So I think you guys will enjoy it. Anyway, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. We'll see you next week. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with last segment being the interview. And I think you guys are going to enjoy it. So stick with us through the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
2024 has the potential to be a wild ride. Are you confident your portfolio is protected? Risk management has never been more important. Join Bulwark Capital's Zach Abraham for his 2024 Outlook live webinar, Thursday, March 28th.
Todd, with the election looming, continued global unrest, rising cost of living, and this crazy market volatility, protecting retirement portfolios has never been more critical, and it's our number one focus.
Don't just ride out 2024. Join Zach for his live webinar and learn how they actively manage every portfolio.
We do it with Bulwark's risk management strategy, always seeking opportunities to lower risk, lower cost, and give you as much upside as possible.
Don't miss Zach's free 2024 Outlook live webinar, Thursday, March 28th. Register now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com.
Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. Thank you for joining us. And it's time for yet another of my favorite parts of the show. The favorite parts of doing the show is somebody joked with me and they said, Zach, I think that you started a radio show just so you could get people to come on. And I was like, well, that's not entirely untrue, right? It's certainly a big benefit. But joined by a repeat guest that's been with us before, but he just put out a recent report. I've been wanting to check in with him and I figured this was a perfect opportunity to do it. So without further ado, Mr. Edwin Dorsey of the Bear Caves report, correct?
Bear Cave newsletter, yeah.
Yeah, the Bear Cave newsletter. And before we get going, let's give folks a little bit of a reminder about, because you are incredibly young to be doing what you're doing. But you know, at the same time, investing is an art, is a skill that is typically found with folks that are of an older age, but there are plenty. I try to explain this to people that like with investing, it involves talent. It just does. It involves not to say that everybody can't be a decent or a good investor. I think they can if they're disciplined, but there's talent with it like anything else. And we've seen multiple examples of these young people coming in and doing really solid work and making waves. And you are no exception to this, my friend. So first of all, why don't you give us a little update about your business and how much it's grown since you started? When did you start doing the report?
I started the Bear Cave newsletter in February 2020. So I was a senior in college, and this is 1 month before the pandemic started. So one way I got extremely lucky starting out is I started my newsletter just before the pandemic. And the pandemic was the best time ever to launch a newsletter. People were bored. People were online. People were looking for something to read. So that's kind of the early ways it started to get big is, you know, people were bored and on Twitter, and I was tweeting out like links to my newsletter, you know, which mainly focuses on exposing corporate misconduct. And that's the early way it started to grow.
And then just as a refresher too,
yeah,
who are, you're a research reporter, but how much does your personal investment book follow? Are you a short seller in your own practice? Because you have that makeup. Short sellers, I am convinced. People are like, well, Zach, you short? Yeah, occasionally, but it's not anywhere close to the majority of what I do, right? Not even close. But would it be fair to categorize you as a short seller?
I don't think that would be how I would describe myself necessarily. Okay. So I have a lot of experience working on the short side. I've interned for a lot of short sellers. I know a lot of short sellers. I was mentored in college by a lot of short sellers. Now, the unique thing about my newsletter, The Bear Cave, is I actually don't bet against any of the companies I write about. I don't take positions. I don't short the stocks. I only make money from reader subscriptions to my newsletter. So I do invest on the long side a little, and I typically don't talk about that. You know, I would say it's a little tough to categorize what I do because no one really exactly does it. There's activist short sellers and they take positions, and there's like journalists, but that's like pure journalism. What I do is like somewhere in between the two. You know, it tends to be what I do in the Bear Cave is I'll typically look for $1 to $10 billion publicly traded companies that I feel are misleading investors or harming customers in some way and write articles criticizing them. Typically 1500 words, typically document based, very qualitative. So I don't really discuss valuations or even numbers that much. It's like qualitative aspects of a business. One thing I'm particularly good with in the newsletter is using the Freedom of Information Act to go to state regulators to get consumer complaints on a business. For example, maybe Planet Fitness has complaints about gym membership cancellations or an insurance company is price gouging people, stuff like that. That's what I really focus on in the newsletter. And then there's a free version that goes out every Sunday where I'll summarize new activist short reports, highlight notable or suspicious executive resignations, and link to some interesting tweets.
Now, again, because of your – and for people that don't know, and you can probably speak to this even better than I can, short sellers are a different breed. They are a different breed. And the reason I think that they're a different breed is, A, they're looking at the markets and they're looking at things through a completely different lens. I personally believe it's one of those things that you can sort of learn how to do, but if you're not naturally that way, you're never going to be able to compete with those guys that, in my opinion, that were born that way, right? That's just the way they see the world. They're also tend to be the best researchers, because if you get a short wrong, your downside is infinite, right?
Yeah.
It's why I always crack up when I hear all these stories about these evil short sellers. Uh-huh. You know, you're looking at them going, man, this has been the longest, biggest bull market in U.S. history. I don't really think the evil short sellers are really messing you up. So to that logic or that line of thinking, do you ever see yourself? Could you feel yourself feeling an attraction or a desire to try your hand on the short side at some point?
I mean, if I wanted to make the most amount of money possible, I should probably launch a hedge fund or a short-biased hedge fund. It's tough to earn more money than like running your own fund.
Yeah.
So there's that. One reason that I don't do the activist short selling route and instead do what I do with the newsletter and paid subscriptions is I think I'm better at the early stage of research, being heavily document-based. If you look at what these activists do, they typically publish a lot less frequently, but do deeper work. They'll hire private investigators. They'll like talk to ex-employees. They might even, you know, they'll go to this extreme like length. And, you know, the risk there is a high risk of being sued. Activist short sellers are sued all the time. I've luckily never been sued. You know, I think there can be like some regulatory scrutiny. As you know, there's been like for years now, some sort of investigation into some short sellers and their trading activity. You know, a lot of times short sellers, they don't just take a position themselves, they'll partner with another fund to take a position and get like a profit sharing agreement. And I think that can be, you know, a little questionable.
A little sticky.
So I like what I do is it's a little more journalistic. It's a little more honest. It fits my kind of mold of trying to like push for corporate accountability, and it's like fun. So for the near future, I think I'm going to stick with my newsletter model.
Got it. Okay. So
all right, guys, due to time constraints, we got to cut this interview off right there. But as always, pretty much every podcast engine out there has it. So you can just Google Know Your Risk Radio podcast. You can hear the rest of the interview if you want to know what's coming up. Have a phenomenal weekend, and we'll see you next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham now at knowyourriskradio.com. Zach will be back with more Know Your Risk Radio next Saturday at noon on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.